Well, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to continue for a moment our conversation with Glenn, who's calling in from Philadelphia. He raised an issue about the book of Jacob. It's been misnamed James after the English egotistical king. The point that you raised is how different Jacob's presentation is from that of Paul. Paul's thesis is launched in Galatians and then shored up in the book of Romans, whereby Paul says that all of the instructions, all of the teaching, all of the guidance that exists in the Torah is moot. That his God authorized him to say that it could not save, to say that it could not save anyone, that it could never save anyone, that it will never be able to save anyone, and that Torah instruction was enslaving, and it was indeed pornographic. And then Paul said, that his God authorized him to tell us that we can exchange all of that information, all of that knowledge, all of that guidance for faith. And so long as we have faith in the cute little goddesses known as the gratia, the graces, that all is hunky-dory with God. So Jacob, whom Shaul, which is his real name, had a real problem with. Shaul hated Yahusha's disciples, hated him with a passion, spoke against Jehochanan, condemned Shimon, had a bitter, bitter rivalry against Jacob. Hated them because they had what Shaul wanted, which was credibility. So Jacob and Shimon both write letters to expose and the lies of Pauline doctrine. And Shimon says that Paul's letters use circular reasoning, that they easily confuse people, and they lead people to their destruction. And with the case of Jacob, he took the approach and said, you know, faith without actions is an absolute waste. Even if it were trust and reliance without actions, a waste. And Yahweh agrees. But don't go to the point where it says that, that salvation is by works. That's not what Jacob is saying at all. Right. It's not what God is saying at all. Let me finish the thought. What God is saying is that I have given you a set of instructions. I have created the covenant. I've invited you to participate in the covenant. I've laid out the terms and conditions of the covenant. I've told you what I'm going to do if you embrace and act upon these terms and conditions. And as part of that, I've laid out a path from your world to my home, which will cause you to be immortal and perfect and will cause you to be adopted into my family. If you don't take the time to observe those instructions, which is an investment, that's an act that you have to choose of your time. If you don't choose to engage and read the instructions, then you've got a zero chance of understanding them, which means you have a zero chance of responding to them. And if you don't respond to them, if you don't act, and you don't answer his invitations, and you don't respond to the terms and conditions of the covenant, then you're as good as dead. That's what Jacob is saying, is that God didn't change his plan. His plan lays out the opportunity for us, but we need to respond to it. And if we don't respond to it, we're as good as dead.
Right.
He was undermining Pauline doctrine.
Right, I understand. You mentioned the term gratia, status of gratia. Certainly the word rendered grace in the New Testament is the Greek word charis. Which gives that, we have the idea of unmerited favor.
But that's not what the word means. The charis, as it's written in Greek, was the name of the charities. They're the same goddesses that were named the gratia in Rome. You can see the charities as they were primarily known. The charis emblazoned all over Greek and Roman temples, They were amongst the most popular pagan goddesses because they were the goddesses of lasciviousness, of partying, of orgies, of sex, of merriment. They were the hedonistic gods of a lascivious lifestyle, and so the Greeks and Romans just loved them. And so when Paul created his gospel of grace, what he's promoting is the lasciviousness of these pagan goddesses, and it is revolting. There is a Hebrew word that speaks of unearned favor. It is the concept is based upon chanan. Yahochanan, for example, is God is merciful. So the concept of mercy is presented throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The whole concept of the covenant and the concept of God's invitations for us to walk from our world to his home is based upon this concept of chanan, of undeserved favor and mercy.
Right. That's what I would say. Right, so setting aside the problems of pagan semantics, the notion of God, I think the idea of unmerited favor correlates well with your idea of God condescending to humanity. It's God who reaches down, to us. Whenever you follow cultural rabbit trails, you always end up with paganities of many kinds.
Well, this is the deal: is that when you name something after, you call it the gospel of grace, and you actually name the principal aspect of your religion after a pagan deity, then you're in serious trouble. That's not just a let's play semantics. God has said, if you memorialize the names of pagan gods that way. Yeah, so it's really, so with Paul, you've got the two issues. With number one, God never said, I'm going to change everything. I'm no longer going to stand by my responsibilities or the requirements of engaging in a relationship with me. God never said that my Torah teaching is impotent and incompetent.
Right.
And so you've got the issue of Paul contradicting God, calling God a complete waste. In fact, Paul presents himself as the Savior. He says, God couldn't complete his testimony, so I have been empowered to complete it. God couldn't complete his sacrifice so that people could receive this mercy, so I'm going to complete it. And Paul became God.
I won't even get into it. Okay, the one thing that I'm thinking here is, the one last point I want to make is, I work with special needs kids, right?
Uh-huh.
My name is Glenn, four letters, and it's Glenn. Mm-hmm. Now, that's my name properly pronounced. Now,
right.
I've worked with kids who can render my name as Gan. Now, if I hear them calling out to me in that word, that name, I respond to them because I know they're not capable of pronouncing my name correctly.
Now you're not going to go from that to Jesus is just because we have a mental deficiency that God's going to
respond to
Jesus.
What I'm saying is if someone has the kernel of a correct notion of Yahusha, as who he is, and erroneously renders his name and yet is referring correctly to the right historical person, personage to manifestation of God, I think God will respond to that and draw that person to him.
Yeah, you got to be a little bit careful here. The moment you focus on Yahusha, whether you know his name or not, your focus is wrong.
Okay.
Your focus is wrong. Yahusha didn't say, hey, look at me. I'm great.
Right.
You ought to pay a lot of attention. No, he pointed to Yahweh.
He testifies of the Father.
And the Father is Yahweh.
Right.
The Father is Yahweh. And the moment your focus is on Yahusha as opposed to Yahweh, and that's what Yahusha means, Yahweh saves. The moment your focus is on the diminished manifestation of Yahweh as opposed to on Yahweh, you ain't going to get to know him. You need to, once you understand who Yahweh is, then you can understand who Yahusha is. But if you go the other way, it's just not going to happen. It just is not going to happen. And that's one of the many problems of Christianity. Not only did they have the name wrong, the title wrong, and his entire nature wrong, it's the wrong focus. And, you know, they pray to him. He said, don't do that. You know, so the problem is a lot bigger than just not knowing his name. Now, I will tell you that as it relates to Yahweh and Yahusha, there is the likelihood of us knowing with absolute certainty how to pronounce it absolutely perfectly, with the emphasis on the right syllable and exactly forming every sound perfectly, is pretty slim. The likelihood of getting it as accurate as we can thoughtfully get it, looking at all of the many thousands of words that are comprised of the 22 Hebrew letters. Now, we can get awfully close.
Well, yeah, vowel pointing and the Masoretes and all that.
Ignoring vowel pointing. The Masoretes were wrong in their vowel pointing. The Masoretes' basic assumption was wrong. The Masoretes said that there are 22 consonants and that they needed to provide vowel pointing so that the words could be pronounced wrong. Of the 22 letters in the Hebrew language, 5 were vowels. Yahweh's name is comprised of 3 of those vowels. In fact, every letter in his name is a vowel because one of the vowels is repeated twice. So the Masoretes actually led us astray. The language has 5 vowels, and there are 17 consonants in the original Hebrew language. And you can look at words like Torah is a great example. The O sound in Torah comes from the Hebrew wa. It's T-O-W-R-A-H. You look at shalom, one of the most common words that we hear. The O sound in shalom comes from the Hebrew wa. Almost every, in fact, if you look at the basis of Yahweh's name, which he said is based upon the verb haya. Well, the verb haya tells you how to pronounce the other two sounds in Yahweh's name, and Torah tells you how to pronounce the third vowel sound. It's really that simple. But if you're making an honest effort to get to know him, as he revealed himself, as he introduced himself, as he made this offer of a covenant known to us, and you make a genuine effort to get to know him, you betcha he'll meet you halfway.
Wow. Yeah, that's him. Yeah, that's by the feeling of our infirmities. He condescends to reach down to us. I'll go now. Your program is shattering myths. You've got quite the China shop to work your way through here.
Boy, is that true. There are more myths than we are ever going to get to in this program. Well, thank you for your call, Glenn. We have Larry on the line, and we've reached a commercial break. But, Larry, if you can stay with us, we'll get right to you after the break. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. What I wanted to do with my friend Larry after the break is I wanted to continue with the Habakkuk 2 prophecy regarding Shaul, because it is so... Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have my good friend Larry having called in, reporting for duty. We had talked about continuing, Larry, to make our way through the Habakkuk prophecy, which is the most devastating prediction, I think, in all of the Torah and prophets. How are you, Larry?
I'm good, Yada. Can I add something here to what Glenn was saying? It was the rabbis that said if you mispronounce Yahweh's name, you'll be put to death. It wasn't Yahweh. He's not trite. He says, surely a person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity who oversteps their bounds to speak words in my name, which I have not instructed nor directed him to speak, and who speaks the name of other Elohim, other gods, indeed that prophet shall die. Now that's Dabarim, what's been renamed Deuteronomy, 1820.
Right.
Now, it's not that Yahweh's trite. He's not worried about us saying, okay, I'll meet you on Monday. He's saying when you memorialize these pagan gods and you put those in my name, I said them, like the Charites, the Gratia, you are dead, because what you've done is you've stepped into religious activity, which is what he berates. It's what Yahusha berated. He called them the walking dead. So a person can either be a part of the walking dead, or they can be empowered by the familial that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
So somebody says to me, your name's Larry, and then I happen to be in another country, and they go, Larry, I still understand what they're saying.
Right. Well, and, the, call me. And there's a difference, too, in that you are a swell guy, but you're just a guy.
I'm just a guy.
You know, you're just a guy. You, I mean, you're just a guy. And God's not just a guy. He is God. He says, I have only one name. He reveals his name 7,000 times in his Torah and prophets. And while he is not uptight in terms of should we mispronounce it, in fact, he uses the term Yah. He uses Yahweh. And he uses it even in truncated ways like Yoel, Joel, Yob. Those are actually Yao, the first two syllables, shortened just to the vowel O, and then with an L at the end of it, meaning Yahweh is God. So does he give various renditions of his name in the sense of these contractions, like Yahusha is Yahweh saves, but Yasha Yahu is salvation is from Yahweh. God is an extraordinarily easygoing and approachable and likable and thick-skinned, if you will. I mean, he's not thin-skinned. He's not insecure. You know, he doesn't zap somebody for mispronouncing his name. But if you don't...
Can I ask you how he wants to be greeted? Is he a religious deity?
No, of course not. But he does make it really clear that if you're going to refer to him as the Lord, you aren't coming into his home. Yeah, you're dead. You're not coming into his home.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
you change.
In Hosea 2:16-17, he says, it shall be in that specific day, prophetically declares Yahweh, you shall encounter and welcome me as an individual. You
right.
will not call me Lord ever
right.
again.
Yeah,
you know,
never again.
And that's clear, because what happens here is when people get off into these religious tangents, they've changed Yahweh's character. And that's what I wanted to say to Glenn.
Yeah.
It's what if you pronounced Larry and said, Larry?
Yeah, well, that's fine. You didn't change your character. But if you take Yahusha and you make him Jesus, you've changed his character, because his name is no longer based on Yahweh, and because his name no longer conveys the fact that it's Yahweh who is saving us, and because his name now is a Latinized, Englishized version of Greek, and he wasn't Greek, and now because that name has associations with pagan deities, you've changed his character. And so,
that's right.
And when you do that, you do run into a serious problem. Let's turn now to back to the Habakkuk passage that we were reading. This is where God is going out of his way to say there's one person, and there's only one person. He is always third person, masculine, singular, and this person is actually named here as Sheol. And Shaul is interesting in the sense that while he's known as Paul, because he chose the Latin name Paulos, which means little and lowly, he reveals that his given name was Shaul, because in his first encounter with the tormenting spirit on the road to Damascus, that spirit yells out to him, Shaul, Shaul, and the spirit was speaking in the Hebrew language according to Shaul. And so we're going to read what Yahweh has to say about this one individual known as Shaul. To Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yana. We're about to dive back into what I would say is perhaps the single most important prophecy as it relates to our world today that Yahweh ever revealed. Now, there's a lot of important prophecies regarding his return and prophecies regarding the end of the age. In fact, the religion of Christianity misconstrues so many of these to create a whole kind of satellite aspect of itself, and with fascination with end times prophecy. They call it eschatology. But this prophecy is vastly more important than anything that God reveals is going to happen over the next 20 years. This prophecy says that the religion that is the most popular in human history, the one based upon Paul's letter, is the plague of death. So let's listen to Yahweh. We're going to begin at the beginning again, Larry, because God begins by framing the issue. He says, upon my requirements, upon my responsibilities and obligations, I have decided I will literally and continually stand. And I choose to always stand and present myself upon which that which protects and fortifies. So I'll be on the lookout in order to see what he, third person singular masculine, will say about me. So the issue has been framed. God has said that he has established requirements for participation in his covenant and for entering his home. And on those requirements, he has personal responsibilities and obligations, where he has said his responsibility is he's the living embodiment of Passover and unleavened bread. And his obligations are that there are five benefits of the covenant. He is obliged to honor those benefits, those promises. And he says, I am going to take my stand on these things. I'm not going to change these things. I'm always going to present myself in accord with my testimony. I'm talking the talk. I'm walking the walk. And I myself, Yahweh saves, the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, part of him set apart from him, is going to be the one who does what is necessary to protect us, to fortify us. So I'll be on the lookout in order to see what he has to say about me. And then he concludes this opening thought with, then how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, my response concerning my disapproving rebuke? Now, God is saying, you know, if you're rational, if you're informed and rational, how is it that you've been fooled by Paul? How would anybody that is informed and rational believe Paul's thesis, which is he claims to have been authorized by God to annul God? I mean, it's just so preposterous. And then Christians say, oh, but, you know, he wants to love all the little children, doesn't want any to die. So it's okay that, you know, that he knows the content of my heart. He's not going to disapprove me. Oh, yeah? Watch. How can I be expected to change my attitude? I've laid out my requirements. I've fulfilled my responsibilities. I'm not changing. You want to get to know me? That's the way. He says, so why in the world would you think that I'm going to change?
He's not.
Then he's just not. Then Yahweh, and if he did, he wouldn't be dependable. That's the other issue with Christianity that I'm just so flabbergasted that you can't be a thinking Christian. Because if your basis is Pauline doctrine, the basis of the religion, and the basic thesis is that God laid out all of this means to salvation, and that it was completely ineffective, no one was saved by it, but then he came up with this entirely new plan that was being articulated through a murderer, Paul.
And incorporated a bunch of pagan gods and goddesses.
And that one's going to work, and that one doesn't have any substance. You just have to believe that he's going to save. And understanding every aspect and complying with every aspect of his previous plan was incapable of saving, and he developed that plan over millennia, but that plan was impotent. It was incapable of operating, but you can believe in this one. What would cause anybody to do that? That's just like saying that you're walking up to this big bully and he punches you right in the snoz. Take that. And then he punches you in the snoz again. And then he punches you in the snoz again. And then this guy comes up and says, you know, I've got a whole new plan where you need to believe that he's not going to punch you in the snoz this time. When he takes his hand out to you, what he's going to do is brush back your hair and make sure that you look really nice. And you say, oh, yeah, I'm going to believe that. Punches you in the snoz again. I mean, come on. That's how stupid it is. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, this is to Habakkuk, which means embrace this great name. God always chooses the name of his prophets beautifully. And if we had embraced this, imagine how different the world would have been. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, write this revelation and then expound and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets so that by reciting this he may run. Now, the reason that these, God never says, you know, I want you to write expounding on something using letters. He's very insistent, saying, I want you to write this down. It's my written testimony that that matters. Read and recite and observe my written testimony. But here he's gone to the point of saying this particular revelation, which is the thing that Paul claims he had, is needs to be expounded using letters on writing tablets. I want it memorialized because I want people to recognize that the thing I'm attacking here is a contrarian written view. So it's my words against his words. My letters against his letters is what God is saying here. And then he's talking about somebody that's claiming that is running. You know, Paul was running a competition, running a race against Yahusha's disciples because he craved the credibility that they had for Yahusha having picked them when he hadn't been picked. And so he craved their credibility, so he was running a race against them. And God is saying, if you recite this, then all of the negative aspects of Pauline doctrine will be separated from you, be distanced from you. All right, moving on to the next statement. Still, indeed, this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. It provides a witness to and speaks in the end. We talked about this yesterday, Larry. There is the appointed meeting time, Moed. When did that occur? When was it?
Yahusha made his sacrifice in 33 CE, and at that time, Paul was in rabbinic school in Jerusalem.
Yeah, that is the appointed meeting time. It is the time of the Moed. Even in the opening stanzas of Yahweh's Torah, when he speaks of the fourth day, the fourth millennia of human history after being expelled from the garden, he speaks of the fourth day being the Moed, the time of the meeting where the greater light would be revealed as a sign. This is precisely what happened, and you are correct. Shaul was in Jerusalem. Gamaliel was the lead rabbi. He was in school learning to be a rabbi. And by the way, the rabbinical techniques permeate all of Paul's letters.
Oh, and by in Acts, Luke writes as Paul's historian, but Luke actually, Paul praises Gamaliel. Yahusha called the offspring of serpents.
That's correct. He did. And in fact, he actually said that he did not convert from Judaism. He makes it very clear. He uses tenses that says that his practice of Judaism is ongoing, that he did not convert from Judaism. He remained rabbinical. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false. God was writing 600 years before this was going to occur, and God said, you know, chill. This is going to happen. At the Moed time, that's 33 CE, and I'm revealing this to you around 600 BCE. Expect him in this regard. Him. Third person, masculine, singular.
Talking about a person.
One individual. Expect him in this regard because he, third person, masculine, singular, will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. In other words, he's going to be here right at the precipice of the Moed. Yeah. For year 4000 Yah, 33 CE on our pagan calendars when Yahusha was in Jerusalem fulfilling and honoring God, taking the stand. The very thing that God said that he was going to do, you know, you're going to count on me taking my stand. Well, Yahusha is there doing exactly that in 33 CE. Pay attention, he says. He will be puffed up with false pride. There has never been a more egotistical person speak on behalf of God than was Shaul. Now,
of course not.
That says a lot. I mean, right.
Yeah,
I mean,
or El Yase.
No.
I say.
No. No.
120 times.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Even Muhammad was not as egotistical as Paul. Paul goes way beyond the. If there was a Richter scale on ego, and 10 was the highest possible number, Paul would be 100. Pay attention. In fact, even Paul says that the only thing that was able to constrain his ego was the fact that he was demon-possessed, and that Satan's ego was such that it limited Paul's ego. A clash of egos, if you will. Pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. Who's the false pride? Satan. His soul, it is not right or straightforward. He does not consider the Torah appropriately, and his reasoning is circuitous. That's exactly what Shaul had to say about him. He twists and convolutes the teaching. It's interesting, by the way, that the call from Glenn, he says, you know, that what you've done here, it's not all that far afield from the Christian Trinity. And while it is night and day different than the Christian Trinity, understanding the set apart spirit and the most set apart being Yahusha, the very fact is that the Christian Trinity is designed to be a counterfeit. And as a counterfeit, the issue is, right, so as a counterfeit, it's very much like this. As a counterfeit, you're creating credibility for your myth based upon corrupting and twisting what God has said. That's why counterfeits work. Satan's religions don't prevail by creating a whole new cloth. They twist and pervert what God said. They create a counterfeit so it appears real. And so now God has said that this individual, he's given the timing of the individual, and he said that he's going to be egotistical, he's going to be puffed up with a false sense of pride, and that he's going to use circuitous reasoning. And so what God says next is, so through trust and reliance, those who are upright and vindicated shall live. So if you want to live, you want to be vindicated, you achieve that through trust and reliance. And God has said what it is that we need to rely upon, which is his requirements. He says, that's where I'm going to take my stand. It's where we have to take our stand. Paul, though, quoted this particular line not once, but twice. Once in Romans, once in Ephesians, in Galatians. In Galatians 3:11, he says, but because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified, which is exactly the opposite of what Yahweh just said. By God,
verse says one thing, Paul says another.
Right. Because by God becomes evident, because those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live. So here's Paul taking a portion of this prophecy, which specifically exposes and condemns him and anyone who follows him, and he twists and uses circular reasoning to annul God's teaching. We'll return on this subject when Shattering Mist returns in a moment. Back to the final segment of Shattering Mist for today. We're continuing with Yahweh's prophecy regarding Shaul. God's next statement is, moreover, because of the inebriating spirit, the intoxicating consequence of a man of deceptive individual, of infidelity and treacherous betrayal. And by the way, man is individual human being. It's written in the singular masculine, Gerber. Moreover, because of the intoxicating nature of this man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal, is high-minded as a moral failure. So this is the guy that's going to deploy kind of high-minded tricks. He's going to come across as if he's in a debate against a God, but his logic will be flawed. His character will be flawed. And so he's now saying, speaking to those who would believe him. And he's saying, he will not find rest. He will not find peace. He will not live. He will not succeed. He will not achieve his aim. He will not reach the goal. Whomever is open to the broad path associated with Shaul. There is no broader path that has ever been conceived in all of human history than Paul's religion, Christianity. There is no religion.
Here, if I could. If you look at the 11th century rabbinic text with the vowel pointing, it will now say Sheol is in a place like, you know, the underworld.
Right.
The problem with that, the place of separation, the problem with that is we're talking about a person, him.
Right.
That's a place. So, since Sheol and Sheol would be written the exact same way in Hebrew, they went with Sheol as opposed to talking about him, who this whole prophecy is about. Just wanted to throw that in.
It's absolutely true that Sheol and Shaul are written identically in the Hebrew text. And so in this particular statement, If God had not said, we're talking about a Gerber, a man. This is the beginning of the sentence says the man, Gerber.
Oh, yeah.
And because it says a man, Gerber, the man, Gerber, not the place
of separation.
It can't be Sheol. Now, there is a connection between Shaul and Sheol, and that is that all of those who promote Shaul will find themselves in Sheol. But the fact of the matter is, this says the intoxicating nature of the man, of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal. You know, Shaul is, Sheol is not a man, and it's Sheol is not deceptive infidelity or treacherous betrayal.
No, it's a place of separation.
It's just a place of separation. And if anything, you would never call Sheol a high-minded moral failure. And this idea that you will not live, which is this idea of wala na'a, when you're associated with the broad path, the fact of the matter is, in Sheol, the reason that Sheol exists is because those souls who associate with the spirit of deception, as Paul claims that he has done, and are demon-possessed or in league with Satan, they become eternal. They live forever separated from God.
Separated with no hope.
Right. Now, this begins again with who. Who is the third person singular masculine pronoun, he. He and his soul. Now, does this place of separation, Sheol, is that a he? No.
No.
Does it have a soul?
No.
No. And so this notion that it is anything other than Shaul is preposterous.
It's outrageous. It's
really?
Like talking about you know, the price of rice in China.
Right. You know? He and his soul are like the plague of death. I mean, there's no more devastating line that God could give. Here is the founder of the broadest path that's ever been conceived. God is saying that it is deceptive infidelity, it is treacherous betrayal, that it is a high-minded failure, that it's intoxicating, and the broadest path that's ever been conceived is Paul's Christianity.
And it says people from different races and different places, right?
Yes. So then he says,
those who are brought together by him, receiving him, cannot be satisfied.
Right. It's the plague of death. Yeah, those who are brought together by him, receiving him, will never be satisfied. They will never find contentment. There will be no fulfillment of any of Paul's promises. That's what he's saying. Most every Gentile will gather together unto him, and they have. And all the people from different races and places. This is through Habakkuk 2:1 through 2:5. We'll continue this tomorrow.